So welcome back after the break. I bet you've been waiting on tenterhooks for this example, haven't you? So we've got Pratitya Samuppada, conditioned co-production, saying that everything arises in dependence upon conditions, and when those conditions cease, the thing ceases. So the example I thought of was a house plant, so something very common and every day. In fact, it's my house plant, and it's in my room. So I live in a community upstairs, and I've had this house plant for over 10 years now, and it's getting very, very tall. It's 7 or 8 feet tall, and it's only just another 6 inches, and it's going to hit the ceiling. I did find out what it's called, and I don't know if I say my Latin correctly, but it's called Dracaena deramensis. So I was thinking, well, what are the conditions that cause that houseplant to be there? What are the conditions? You know, why? You know, what? How can we apply Pratitya Samuppada, conditioned co-production, to this houseplant? Because accordingly, it applies to all phenomena, everything. So it'll include this houseplant, surely. It requires sunlight, but not too much sunlight, because it's one of these ones, it needs to be a bit in the shade. It needs to be in soil, it needs to be fed every now and then, it needs water. Now that's a condition that it doesn't always get, and I do forget. For instance, I've just been 2 week retreat, and it either did very well and survived without me, or it might be one of my friends might have popped in and watered it for me. So maybe one of the conditions also is me as well, because if I don't care about it, if I forget all about it, it's going to die and it's not going to. Or say if I went away for a long time, I would be one of the conditions ceasing, and so my houseplant would cease. But also to do with my taste in houseplants as well. So if I suddenly decide I don't like it anymore, well, it might end up in the skip, you know, it might end up in the rubbish bin. But what are the conditions that, you know, what's conditioned me to what I like and don't like? Well, that's basically, you know, how I was brought up, you know, the conditions I had when, you know, growing up in the Midlands. In the 1970s and 1980s, my family conditions. Then you can trace all that back, can't you? Because you can think, well, it was how I was brought up from my parents and their parents and their parents. And you can see it, the conditions are going further and further back to all of my ancestry. And you can see very soon, actually, it's going back to all of humanity. But also there's the plant's history as well, and I don't know a lot about this, but presumably it's been taken from the wild at some point and pruned and done things to. So it's become a domestic plant, and maybe it's been, I don't know quite what the word is, when you bring two plants together and... Anyway. Sorry? Grafting, yeah, could be grafting, you know, graft two plants together. And anyway, I'm getting out of my area of what I'm talking about. But then you have a look inside, and there's all the cells inside a plant, you know, and all that they're conditioning each other and supporting life. You've got photosynthesis going on. But you go even further, and you've got all the atomic and subatomic particles that are inside the plant. So hopefully what you're seeing is that actually the whole conditions, it's an infinite set of conditions. In fact, the whole, as it were, the whole universe is conditioning that houseplant to be there, and the whole of time, you know. So because everything is, what it's saying is everything is connected. And that's for every single phenomena, every single thing in the universe is ultimately connected to everything else. There's nothing that stands apart, nothing separate. So I'm just going to read you another quote. And this is Kulananda, a very good book called Western Buddhism. So he says, all the phenomena of the world, without exception, arise in dependence upon conditions. And with the cessation of those conditions, the phenomena which depend upon them also cease. Behind, above, beyond this vast network of conditions, there exists nothing at all. The entire vast, unfathomable cosmos is nothing but an ever-changing network of related conditions. And wherever we look into it, if we look with a calm, concentrated and fearless gaze, we see infinite depths of interconnectedness. Seeing in this way with the unclouded eye of spiritual insight is to see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. So he's quoting Blake there at the end. So I think that he's bringing to life what Pratitya Samuppada is. It's this, it's not a theory, it's not some super theory which the Buddha came up with, but just a simple observation that everything is conditioned and there's nothing, as it were, behind that conditioning. And the whole of Buddhism can be worked out from Pratitya Samuppada, from conditioned co-production. And it's pointing to the fact there's multiple conditions, so it's not simple cause and effect, one cause and one effect. Multiple conditions coming together. And this arising and ceasing is also happening at the same time. There's no one point of where it's arising, one point ceasing. When a bud ceases, the leaf arises on a plant. So when you think about it, there's no point when you just get arising, but you're getting arising and ceasing all the time, this flow. As I was saying before, it applies to everything, from atoms, galaxies, to the spiritual life, to the consciousness. So I thought I'd stop there and just, or pause, and just wondering if there's any comments or questions. Hello, Paul.
Yeah. So you're saying that nothing happens out of a sort of spontaneous randomness.
Hmm.
But why is that important?
Well, I guess part of what's important about that is the fact that we can trust in there are regularities and processes in the universe, if you like, in life, that we can cooperate with. I'll be coming on to this later, but we can cooperate with and utilise, if we like. So, for instance, growth and development, spiritual growth, is something that is inherent in our consciousness. It's something which is, if we utilise, if we cooperate with, we can grow in development and develop. But it's not random. Yeah. So we can when we learn about that, when we can trust that, we can just set the conditions in place and grow and develop from that. That makes sense. Yeah. So that's one particularly important way for us to that randomness is well. Also, you know, if it's totally random, it would point to chaos and nihilism. Where, well, what does it matter if we do? You know, we might as well go out shopping and partying. You know, because, well, if it's all chaotic and random. And if that sort of
not sure.
Yeah.
It's obviously a very important concept because I keep coming across it all the time. So I never really understood it as a foundation.
Sure.
Something that I'm kind of missing, you know.
Sure. Well, maybe it's something we need. I think we need to come back to it again and again in a way. And maybe I'm I don't know if I'm explaining it well enough, but yeah, it did, but it is something that which is it's just, you know, the Buddha was did stress was very. He was saying, for those that see conditioned co-production, see the Buddha. So he was very much putting it at the centre of his teaching.
Is it about sort of setting the right conditions for yourself? So, you know, it's not random. So if you set up the right conditions for yourself, you're going to be able to grow. And
that's right. And that's right. Exactly. That's a really good point, because it's realising that setting up the right conditions for us does enable us to grow and develop, and we can trust in that. And those might be generic, they might be the same for everyone. Going out on retreat, spending space, and time in the countryside.
Instead of going out on the
But also some of them will be individual conditions as well that we need to work out for ourselves. I mean, this is the basic principles, if you like, but then we need to do a lot of working this through practically wise. And the Buddha did it himself, and this is something that the LBC is doing, Tree Ratna is doing as well. But I think you're right, it is setting up the right conditions. And as Jnanavarchi was saying at the break, just going on retreat, it already, you're putting in conditions that, you know, that are actually helping you grow and develop even before you start making the effort, as it were. So there are certain conditions which are just naturally very helpful. Hello, Jen.
You said there's nothing else. There's nothing outside this.
Yes.
There's nothing behind that. It's a natural law. And you said there's no external God figure. From that way, from your description, I'm imagining you mean there's no. If we're thinking of a created God, then there's something outside of all this.
Yes.
That creates it and puts it. Sets it in motion or something.
Yes, that's right.
But is there a concept, a notion of God that isn't creator God? Because when people say God, they seem to mean that.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? I think I was reading recently that there was somebody was saying there was three aspects to the idea of God. One was to do with being the creator. Another one was being the judge. Who, you know, judged your actions, presumably at the end of time or whatever. But then the third one was, I think it was something to do with being a loving presence in the universe. You know, and maybe maybe that third one could be akin to, you know, something that Buddhists could agree with. But the danger is that once we start calling things God, you know, then it's got a whole host of associations with it. In a way, the problem with using language is that we start to pin things down, we start to take things very literally. And so Buddhism uses language, but then tries to not get too fixed on language and try and hold things as a mystery. So, again, something we're going to see a bit later. We can have, for instance, spiritual experiences, but it's the interpretation we put on that depends on how we deal with that experience. So somebody might have a spiritual experience and then label it as God. God touching them, grace descending from God, and has a whole lot of implications. And it really depends on your points of view there. So Buddhism really tries to avoid getting into that. Yeah. I don't know if that kind of makes sense or helps.
Yeah, that helps if I think of the third one.
Mm. So, any more? Shall we move on? Okay, so anyway, this is setting out the principles, looking at principally. But I suppose mainly the relevance is this, is what it's saying is it applies to us. So it applies to all phenomena, but it applies to us. And for instance, what we talked about conditions, you know, where, well, what conditions brought us here tonight? And, you know, again, we can think through, you know, well, the bus or the tube, or, you know, we walked, and or who drove the tube and who built the bus. But also ourselves. Why did we come here tonight? You know, what were the conditions that caused us to come here tonight? So part of Pratichasamutpada was that the Buddha saw there was no fixed separate essences. So as he's saying here, there's nothing behind all the conditions. Quite often we label things, and it's just quite a normal thing we do. It's a normal thing we do with language. But his vision was that he saw everything was impermanent and flowing, and everything is in process. Well, everything is a process. So there's processes rather than things. Or a process is a more helpful way of understanding things than things, if you know what I mean. So these processes, there's a rising and ceasing dependent upon conditions. And it applies to us, it applies to the self. So we instinctively believe that there is a fixed, real, immutable self that goes through life essentially unchanged. Okay, so this is one of the Buddha's, again, another essential of his essential teachings. Anatman, or no self, or rather no fixed self. It shouldn't be understood as we don't exist, but it's rather saying we don't exist as we think we do. So we tend to have a sense that there's an I or a me which is unchanging. We're just going through life having experiences. And I think I believe I'll continue indefinitely. Although I kind of know I'm going to die, actually I think some part of me doesn't kind of buy into that. You know, I don't know if I'm the only one, but, you know, that feels, you know, there's a sense of I can't quite get my head around it. And, well, Buddhism says this belief is rooted very, very deeply. It's below our conscious mind. But we act from this belief all the time. The Buddha was saying that this belief in a fixed separate self is illusory. And it's our deepest delusion, this fixed self. So it's more helpful to think, well, we're like the houseplant. You know, we are conditioned by a whole host of factors, a whole host of conditions. And when those conditions cease, well, we will cease. But we have to use language, don't we? We use language like I and we. And that's really useful, you know, because, for instance, running for the bus or whatever, you know, we need it day to day. But in terms of ultimate truth, it doesn't really hold water. So, yeah, we don't exist in quite the way we think, but something more mysterious is happening. So, there's a Buddhist practices where you can look for this I. And say, okay, where is I? Where is me? And they, you know, people say, well, is it in the body? So they look for it in the body. You say, well, no, I can't find it in the body. The body changes. All my cells, the last 7 years, our cells and our body have changed. So it can't be there. Is it in our mind? Well, what's in our mind? Thoughts? You know, is it in our heart? So there's this practice where you eventually find that you can't pin I anywhere. And you realise that it is just an idea, a very useful and practical idea, but it is just an idea. But we cling to this idea of self, and we grasp at people or things that shore up this belief. So if we begin to examine our experience, we grasp or cling to people or things that shore up this belief. We push away anything that threatens this idea, and we ignore how things really are. And it's, you know, this is just the way we're made. You know, we don't really want to face up to reality. We all know things are impermanent, but we don't like to dwell on it because it's just very uncomfortable. So we have a fixed identity. We hold on to our sense of who we are through our jobs, our bodies, our partners, our general identity. But me is just a process, physical, energetic, psychological. And we are processes in a universe of processes. And part of this belief in self is that we believe we are the centre of our universe, or we act from that. That may sound a little bit shocking, but if you look at your experience, you probably do. I mean, all the senses seem to show that, yes, I am the centre of the universe. And I relate everything to me. Even subtly, it all seems to relate back to me. And hopefully, you know, through spiritual practice, we lessen that. We have a looser sense of self and become more other-regarding. So, yeah, I or me, what Buddhism is saying, it's an abstraction. It's mind-made. But Buddhism invites us to look beyond this and actually what's happening in our experience. So, how does that strike you? Would we go along with that? Do we disagree?
Caught my attention actually.
Yeah.
When you said we cling to the idea of self.
Yeah, yeah.
So, already in, like, there are two elements, I see, like, the one that clings to the idea itself, and always the one who clings, it's also an idea, or maybe it's just the clinging, I don't know.
Oh, I see, yeah. I suppose you can say there's self-clinging, in a way. There is. That's just part of... It's like we there is self-orientation, self-reference, self-clinging going on. Mm-hmm. Trying to use language to describe what's going on. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'm expressing what I see well, but it's just like when I reflect on the idea of self.
Yes.
Where am, like, what is the part of me that is reflecting?
Yes.
On that?
Yes.
It's still the self.
Yes. Interesting. Yeah. So I think, well, Buddhism wouldn't see. There's definitely consciousness there, there's something evaluating, there's volitions and perceptions. They're all happening. But we bundle them all up into, and then we call it me. So, and then we attribute a subject and an object. So we call it self, and then we have everything else is other. So the processes are going on, and Buddhism doesn't deny our experience at all. It's just that the interpretation that we give to our experience, the Buddha was saying, is that's where we go wrong. Does that make sense? Yeah.
can you say something about
consciousness?
When somebody says consciousness is always there, we need to connect with it. I'm wondering whether that's meaning enlightened consciousness, but also there's just consciousness, awareness, isn't there? How that term is used in so many different ways.
Yes, I think it's... Well, the way I understand it, it's consciousness is synonymous with awareness. So that's the way I understand it. But also awareness can be understood in, you know, it's not, awareness isn't just a sort of a, just a simple faculty. It's something that can be cultivated and developed and deepened. You can have, you know, you can imagine the Buddha's awareness is completely different from my awareness or something. You know, he's seeing things in a certain way, which he's seeing things the way things are, as it were.
So in the Heart Sutra, when it says consciousness is it referring to enlightened consciousness?
Yeah, what's it saying in the Heart Sutra?
Even consciousness
is empty. I think it's saying that
it's referring to consciousness as one of the skandhas, though, isn't it? The Heart Sutra, so just as you described,
yes,
our experience is made up of the skandhas.
Yes.
It's describing that as just another process.
That's right. Thanks, David. Yeah.
So consciousness is just another of the processes.
It's another of the five skandhas, isn't it? So it's another of the processes. Yeah. I'm not sure I'm being too helpful around that, but. Sorry, Richard.
Yeah. You mentioned that the self is beneath consciousness, I think you said, didn't you? Originates beneath consciousness. Did you say something like that earlier?
Don't think so.
Did you not?
No.
I've spent a long time wondering why we do have a sense of self and where it does come from.
Yeah.
And I thought I read somewhere that the Buddha said it was actually the flip side of consciousness. Self. I'm afraid I don't really remember what I read.
Right.
You might have.
I'm afraid I haven't come across that. I mean, again, my understanding is that it's in a delusion. It's more of an abstraction. It's a fundamental wrong view. It's a belief that doesn't hold water. Not with our.
I just wonder why we
do it. Well, I mean, one idea. I mean, again, the Buddha didn't like to get into too much ideas about why things are. But I suppose we might, from our, you know, scientific age, we might look at evolution, and see there might well have been advantages to, having a self. You know. A sense of, you know, there's me, because then you can make choices. You know, an animal that can make choices probably has an evolutionary advantage, maybe. Mm. So that's a possibility.
Yeah,
from.
No, I can hear what you mean.
Can you sort of interest the idea of the self is affected though by everything around us, isn't it? You know, somebody says something nice to us, it can change our mood. So even though our sense of ourself. Dependent on what's outside of us, watching us and coming in contact with us.
That's right. Our experience changes because we are interconnected with.
There's a sort of way of softening that sense of us being the centre of the universe. It's we're not, we exist in relation to the things around us.
Yes, that's right. And I think one of the things the Buddha's pointing to is that it's. The sense of self is a sort of separate, standing apart from everything else, that we believe is happening, but actually the reality is that we're very, very intermingled, interconnected with everything else. Okay.
Be the consciousness, be our capability to feel our light inside, to feel our soul and extreme indestructibility, the fact that this eternal, unlimited love from the inside light, would it be this consciousness, feeling of it, the capability of having a connection to this intelligence?
I'm sort of getting the Buddha, the Buddha's consciousness, if you like, the Buddha's awareness, enlightened mind, is one that's full of love and full of compassion, but also full of wisdom as well. So from a Buddhist perspective, it's something we can grow into. We can become more, as Nyanavacha was saying in the break, we can become more than what we are, you know, so we can become wiser, kinder, more generous, we can see things more clearly, and we can embody those qualities, we can embody love more and more, until, you know, enlightenment, where the Buddha has fully embodied all those positive qualities that are possible, if you like. I don't know if that sort of gets at me.
Just ask myself, what is consciousness? And for me, it makes sense like this.
But it's really interesting, you know, sort of thinking about these things, isn't it? You know, thinking about, well, what is consciousness? What is my awareness? What I'm aware of? You know. Okay, so let's move on. So there's been a bit of a background. We've looked at conditioned co-production. We looked how it also relates to ourselves as well. So that's a bit of background I wanted to cover, at least in part, hopefully we've got some sense of it, before beginning to look at the paper. So Subhuti starts the paper talking about Buddhism as a path from where we are now to enlightenment. So if you've been coming along to the talks by Maitra Bandhu, you'll see that, well, you might already see there's a metaphor coming up there. So it's flagged up as a metaphor, the metaphor of the path. So that's widely used in Buddhism, a sense of a path from where we are now to somewhere, you know, to enlightenment. Another metaphor would be one of growth and development. So imagining we could be like, well, the metaphor is like a plant or a flower, something that grows. And they've both got their advantages, they've both got their disadvantages, but it's really important to sort of look at those metaphors. So this metaphor is a path, and we're going from a state where we're now, where we've a belief in a illusory, this delusion of a self, this illusory self, from self-clinging, to the Buddha, where he's gone beyond, he's transcended the self, he's seen through this delusion of self. Because he's seen through it, a whole host of things have occurred. He's freed up huge amounts of energy. He's completely compassionate. He's identifies with all life. He sees things the way they are, completely generous, completely, you know, he's completely content with his experience. So, he's full of wisdom, compassion, energy, creativity, freedom. So in a way you can see as the Buddhist path is treading, you know, we can become like that, the Buddha is saying, and we need to tread the path using that metaphor. So so as we tread the path, there's actually the path can be described in two different ways: as the mundane path, and the transcendental path. And these are different parts of the path. First, we tread the mundane path, and then we tread the transcendental path. And the difference between the two is the mundane path is where we're still believing in the self. We've still got the illusion of self. And the transcendental path is when we've really seen through that that sense of self. So Subhuti is saying the crux of the Dharma life is the transition from this mundane path to the transcendental path. So using another analogy, it's like, a space rocket leaving the Earth's gravitational pull. So whilst the rocket is going up, it's fighting hard to leave the gravitational pull. But there's some point where it can leave gravity behind, and it doesn't experience that pull back, and it will go on its journey. And on the Buddhist path, this is a decisive point where the illusion of self has been seen through. It's called stream entry, traditionally called stream entry. And at that point, the image, another image, is that we enter a stream, and then the stream carries us to enlightenment. And once we've entered the stream, this is irreversible. All the conditions we've set into place then become, we enter in irreversibly. Something else comes through that then supports us, that takes us to enlightenment. There's forces or processes in the universe that come into being at that point that take us to enlightenment. And so Subhuti was saying in the paper that not only there's processes that help us initially on the path that we need to cooperate with, but also there's the processes that help us to become Buddhas. Again, it's going back to the thing about being random. It's not a random thing. We just need to put the conditions in place. And again, this is said very glibly. These are principles, and there's a lot of the devil in the detail. There's a lot of working out of this. But the principles are that it's not something random. It's not something that we need to... it is something that we just need to set the right conditions up, and spiritual growth will occur. So that does that make sense? Mundane and transcendental. I know. Again, I think I'm throwing a lot of ideas at you today, aren't I? You know, and the good thing, over the weeks we'll be looking at a lot of these ideas again and again. So just thinking, don't get put off by. A lot of this.
I wonder how, if everything arises dependent on conditions, can we actually change, put in the conditions for something like enlightenment to arise? We've arrived.
Yeah. Kind of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, sort of thing. How does that? Yeah.
Is it just that we're incredibly
lucky that by conditions we've landed up here? I think, there's things we do ourselves. We decide to practice, we decide to meditate, practice the precepts as well. But this other, if you like, we're going to look at the processes later on in the talk. They're, as it were, beyond us. as it were, pulling us or trying to sort of pull us beyond ourselves. So, in a way, we do a lot of work ourselves, but also we become more attuned to these processes which are trying to help us, if you like, practice and help us, drawing us along. Yeah. So there's sort of what they call in the tradition self-power and other power. It's something we have our own efforts, but also there is something else.
Stop fighting what's already there.
So it's an as well, it's an as if, you know, as if there is something else pulling us.
Yeah, and when we stop fighting it, then conditionality disappears.
So yeah, so trying to learn to cooperate with those processes. Okay. So, traversing the path, how do we do it? How do we do it? So we've sort of looked at things in principle, but how do we do it actually in practice? So yeah, if we cooperate with these processes, these natural processes, we can grow and develop. And as I was saying before, you know, so we're relying on conditioned co-production. So going back to Buddha Ghosha, Buddha Ghosha lived in the 5th century in India. And he was a scholar. He was also a monk. And he categorised 5 niyamas, he was called. They're groups in which conditioned co-production can operate. And these are laws of conditionality governing sets of processes. So you sort of split conditionality, conditioned co-production, into 5 orders of processes. And Sangharakshita has taken these and reworked them and included some modern concepts. So I've written them up here. So 5 niyamas: utu, bija, mano, karma and dharma. So just going to have a look at these, and then hopefully this will begin to help us understand how, you know, the processes can help us grow and develop. So saying that the utu niyama is to do with processes to do with inorganic matter. What in modern science would be called, you know, is covered by physics and chemistry. So it's to do with conditions and the results of conditions. The law, for instance, of thermodynamics, law of gravity, electricity, chemical reactions, atoms, and so forth. All covered within this group of the utu niyama. So it's all very well covered under modern science. The next order up is the bija niyama, and this covers living organisms. And it's an increasing level of complexity, and is covered by biology, botany, physiology. And examples of this is photosynthesis, genetic inheritance, circulation of the blood, and such forth. Lots of different laws governing all of this. So I'll just stop there. Is that, do those two make sense? Any questions around that? Yeah. Okay. So the third one is mano niyama. And this is the laws governing organisms that have sensory perception. So, covered by zoology, behavioural science. And it includes sort of basic psychology, perceptions, reflexes, stimulus response reactions, instincts. So, fight or flight. But it also can include very complex responses found in animals, such as migratory instincts of birds, or survival strategies, or I don't know, the emperor penguin. You know, I don't know if you know about him, with the way they look after their egg. You know, they're there on the ice shelf in the middle of nowhere. And I think the male looks after the egg for months on end. Anyway, I can't remember all of it. But it's just remarkable how life supports itself. And so this covers this sort of, it's below self-reflexive consciousness. So it's not human consciousness, but it includes our own basic psychology, our own instincts. In fact, the first three, Utu, Bija and Mano, Niyamas, are all within our experience. So we've all got those going on. We've got physics and chemistry, we've got biology within us, but also this basic basic psychology, instincts and such forth. Yeah. So, if we move further up, each of these levels gets more and more at the kind of an order of complexity. And if you like, one way of looking at it is one leads on from the other. You can look at it from an evolutionary perspective. You know, out of the warm soup of amino acids, life sprang. So you move from the Utu to the Bija Niyama. And then life developed sensory perception, a certain level of instincts, and you move to more and more complex animals. And at some point we had self-reflexive consciousness developed. And this one is covered by the Karma Niyama. And this is where it gets interesting. This is where it gets interesting and it gets really relevant to what we do in the spiritual life. So self-reflexive consciousness is that we're aware that we are aware. There's a me. This is where the self comes in. There's a me, there's an I. And we're at the centre of our experience. And we understand that we do certain actions, they have consequences. And here we have law of karma. And the karma literally means action. So, and the law of karma is saying that actions have consequences. And these actions are conscious actions, they're willed actions. They're not our unconscious things that we do, but the things that we actually consciously and will do, volitions. And what the law of karma is saying is the relationship between our actions and consequences. And within Buddhism, there's actions of body, speech and mind. They're all seen as actions. So things we do with our body are actions. Our speech is seen as an action. But also our intentional thoughts are seen as actions as well. So, for instance, when we practice the precepts, we have precepts that cover the body, precepts that cover speech, and also precepts that cover mind. It's saying that we can actually choose in all of these areas. So the law of karma is saying that there are consequences to our actions, and it has effect on others, but also on ourselves. And these actually begin to reshape the mind. What we say, do and think has effect on ourselves and reshapes the mind moment to moment. Now, if our actions are based in greed, hatred, or delusion, very self-centered motivations, then that will just reinforce that. So states of mind are classified as skillful or unskillful. Unskillful are ones that are based in greed, hatred, and delusion. Very self-oriented, self-centered. And skillful actions, skillful states of mind are the opposite. One's based on generosity, contentment. One's based on love, truthfulness, mindfulness. So not only will we have a beneficial effect on the world if we act skillfully or helpfully, but we have a greater degree of fulfillment and enriched experience. So what it's saying here is actually we can decide, and the way we act, and the way we act has an effect on our consciousness, on our experience. So we can actually create our experience. We can have a richer, more fulfilling experience of life. Or we do it the other way around, we can have a more unpleasant, scattered experience, and it's really up to us. In a way, the Buddha is saying that we do have that choice, ultimately. And the more responsibility we take over over ourselves, our actions, the Buddha is inviting us to take responsibility. So the five precepts are seen as training principles. We can train in them, and we can begin to train our minds, train our hearts. And they can help us grow, help us grow and develop. And what the five precepts are doing are we begin to act in accordance with the way things are. Again. Just wondering if anything's come up. Hi, Paul. Yeah.
So what's the point of dividing all those different phenomena into groups? Because obviously they're all freely interdependent anyway.
Yes, that's right. That's right. They're not separate. As it were, they all interconnect. It's just it's a helpful way of dividing them in a way. It's saying that, I mean, in the spiritual life, it's those top two, karma and dharma niyama, which are most important for us, most helpful for us, because it's where we begin to, we cooperate with these processes will help us grow and develop. The other ones, in a way, they're states of complexity. It's something that Buddha Gosha, looked at, in the 5th century and drew, saw that there were differences. Also, each of these orders of, each of these niyamas holds different levels of consciousness, if you like. And there's a sort of level of complexity and of consciousness as you go up the niyamas. Just a helpful way of sort of dividing things up. Don't know if that's...
Occurs to me, actually, there's sort of a wrong view about karma that this sort of clarifies as well. There's a sort of the wrong view about karma that is... bad things happen to bad people.
Interesting. Yeah.
There was
yeah.
an earthquake. A lot of people said, well, yeah. actually, it's good all the sin will be bad people.
Yes.
It's sort of a wrong view about karma. But this sort of says, well, actually, there's these processes going on at this level.
Yes.
That we can't really control.
Yes. Yes.
But actually, a few levels up, there are these processes going on that we do have control.
That's right.
And that's that sort of the more Buddhist view of karma.
Yes, yes.
Some sort of psychological, spiritual.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, thanks, David. I think that's really helpful because, yeah, we can have a simplistic notion of karma, like David was saying. We can say everything, well, that's your karma sort of thing, that everything was karma, but actually it's saying that things happening to us, there could be a whole host of conditions that have caused me to have a headache. It could be I've banged my head, it could be, which is utu, it could be I've got a cold, it's the bija nirma. It could be, you know, I've got myself into all sorts of psychological knots or something, very stressed, say. So you can say it's a mano nirma. So in a way, it sort of makes it more of an intelligent way of looking rather than this sort of simplistic notion that sometimes can be popular, a notion of karma. Does that help? No. I was just wondering if it helped with your question. So. No, no. Okay. I think the thing also with karma is that it's probably more helpful to think of it in what we do now affects our future, if you like, rather than worrying too much about what, you know, what's caused us to be here now, as it were. It's really tricky. Cooperating with these processes and actually using karma, if you like, to have a richer and deeper experience.
Well, I suppose it tells you that karma is not those other three or four things, doesn't it?
Mm.
So that if something's happening to you,
you
can say to yourself, well, this is something that I have got control of, or this is something I don't have control of.
There's one element that you do, you know, you can actually begin to change in your life, our willed action. We can decide to practice, we can decide to get up and meditate in the morning, we can decide to be generous.
But I can't decide not to have this cold.
Ah, right, yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly.
And we could I think I can.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an interplay between all of those things as well, isn't there? It's not exclusively one thing that's happening.
No.
That's what you were saying before, really.
That's right.
But you can choose, you know, there are also some ways that you can choose to have an influence over the utu nirma or the bija nirma.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you can choose to influence what happens in your body.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
That's right.
You can choose what happens in your garden to an extent, you can influence that. And,
that's right. That's
you know, so all of these things are going on all the time, but it's what's happening to a greater or lesser extent, and some of those things are channeled through each other as well.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. It does. Thanks. Yeah. I think we can also think of spiritual practice as sort of, well, being aware of those first three. You know, we're aware of physical sensations in the body, we're aware of our feelings, we're aware of our thoughts. Part of practice is getting to be aware of our psychology. What's our basic psychology type? Because then we can work better with it, you know. Being really in touch with our physical sensations, the direct sensations, is very important. Mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of the body and movements. Just noticing what's there. So it's something we can very much part of spiritual practice.
Because I think that's what is striking about all of it as well, is that you only have an influence to the degree to which you're aware.
Yes. Yeah.
So if there's no awareness, then there's no, you know, it's that moment when there's consciousness, isn't there?
Actually,
that was part of my question, because I noticed that when I am in a negative state of mind, it doesn't feel like I have choice. Like, I need to be positive and aware of the moment.
Yes.
And the fact that I am making a choice anyway.
Yes, yes.
to then be able to choose differently or just the same thing, but still be aware that it's my choice.
Yes, yes, yeah.
But unless there is some degree of awareness, then there's no, really, in a way, there's no choice. Like,
That's right, there needs to be a level of, like you say, that does need to be awareness there for you to realise there is a choice, because sometimes we feel we're stuck in something and we don't feel we have a choice. So having a creative response maybe to what we do. So, well, it is 9:15, so I'm afraid we're going to have to stop there. It's right in the middle of Karma Nema. But Subhadramati will be doing next week's seminar, so she will be continuing with this. So hopefully you'll come back and we'll be looking further at the paper. So thanks a lot for coming, and hope to see you next week.
Thank you.